Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 35. It's June 17th, 2020. A specter is haunting Eastern Europe. The specter of what in the West is called dissent. This specter has not appeared out of thin air. It is a natural and inevitable consequence of the present historical phase of the system it is haunting. It was born at a time when this system, for a thousand reasons, can no longer base itself on the unadulterated, brutal, and arbitrary application of power, eliminating all expressions of nonconformity. What is more, the system has become so ossified politically that there is practically no way for such nonconformity to be implemented within its official structures. Who are these so-called dissidents? Where does their point of view come from? And what importance does it have? What is the significance of the independent initiatives in which dissidents collaborate? And what real chances do such initiatives have of success? Is it appropriate to refer to dissidents as an opposition? If so, what exactly is such an opposition within the framework of this system? What does it do? What role does it play in society? What are its hopes and on what are they based? Is it within the power of the dissidents as a category of subcitizen outside the power establishment to have any influence at all on society and the social system? Can they actually change anything? I think that an examination of these questions, an examination of the potential of the powerless, can only begin with an examination of the nature of power in the circumstances in which these powerless people operate. Our system is most frequently characterized as a dictatorship, or more precisely, as the dictatorship of a political bureaucracy over a society which has undergone economic and social leveling. I'm afraid that the term dictatorship, regardless of how intelligible it may otherwise be, tends to obscure rather than clarify the real nature of power in this system. We usually associate the term with the notion of a small group of people who take over the government of a given country by force. Their power is wielded openly, using the direct instruments of power at their disposal, and they are easily distinguished socially from the majority over whom they rule. One of the essential aspects of this traditional or classical notion of dictatorship is the assumption that it is temporary, ephemeral, lacking historical roots. Its existence seems to be bound up with the lives of those who established it. It is usually local in extent and significance, and regardless of the ideology it utilizes to grant itself legitimacy, its power derives ultimately from the numbers and the armed might of its soldiers and police. The principal threat to its existence is felt to be the possibility that someone better equipped, in this sense, might appear and overthrow it. Even this very superficial overview should make it clear that the system in which we live has very little in common with a classical dictatorship. In the first place, our system is not limited in a local geographical sense. Rather, it holds sway over a huge power block controlled by one of the two superpowers. And although it quite naturally exhibits a number of local and historical variations, the range of these variations is fundamentally circumscribed by a single unifying framework throughout the power block. Not only is the dictatorship everywhere based on the same principles and structured in the same way, that is, in the way evolved by the ruling superpower, but each country has been completely penetrated by a network of manipulatory instruments controlled by the superpower center and totally subordinated to its interests. In the stalemated world of nuclear parity, of course, that circumstance endows the system with an unprecedented degree of external stability compared with classical dictatorships. Many local crises, which in an isolated state would lead to a change in the system, can be resolved through direct intervention by the armed forces of the rest of the bloc. In the second place, if a feature of classical dictatorships is their lack of historical roots, frequently they appear to be no more than historical freaks, the fortuitous consequence of fortuitous social processes or of human and mob tendencies, the same cannot be said so facilely about our system. For even though our dictatorship has long since alienated itself completely from the social movements that gave birth to it, the authenticity of these movements, and I'm thinking of the proletarian and socialist movements of the 19th century, gives it undeniable historicity. These origins provided a solid foundations of sorts on which it could build until it became the utterly new social and political reality it is today, which has become so inextricably a part of the structure of the modern world. A feature of these historical origins was the correct understanding of social conflicts in the period from which these original movements emerged. The fact that at the very core of this correct understanding, there was a genetic disposition towards the monstrous alienation characteristic of its subsequent development is not essential here. And in any case, this element also grew organically from the climate of that time and therefore can be said to have its origins there as well. One legacy of that original correct understanding is a third peculiarity that makes our systems different from other modern dictatorships. It commands an incomparably more precise, logically structured, generally comprehensible, and in essence, extremely flexible ideology than in its elaborateness and completeness is almost a secularized religion. It offers a ready answer to any question whatsoever. It can scarcely be accepted only in part, and accepting it has profound implications for human life. In an era when metaphysical and existential certainties are in a state of crisis, when people are being uprooted and alienated and are losing their sense of what this world means, this ideology inevitably has a certain hypnotic charm. To wandering humankind, it offers an immediately available home. All one has to do is accept it, and suddenly everything becomes clear once more. Life takes on a new meaning, and all mysteries, unanswered questions, anxiety, and loneliness vanish. Of course, one pays dearly for this low-rent home. The price is abdication of one's own reason, conscience, and responsibility. For an essential aspect of this ideology is the consignment of reason and conscience to a higher authority. The principle involved here is that the center of power is identical with the center of truth. In our case, the connection with Byzantine theocracy is direct. The highest secular authority is identical with the highest spiritual authority. It is true, of course, that all this aside, ideology no longer has any great influence on people, at least within our bloc, with the possible exception of Russia, where the serf mentality, with its blind, fatalistic respect for rulers and its automatic acceptance of all their claims, is still dominant and combined with a superpower patriotism, which traditionally places the interests of empire higher than the interests of humanity. But this is not important because ideology plays its role in our system very well, an issue to which I will return, precisely because it is what it is. Fourth, the technique of exercising power in traditional dictatorships contains a necessary element of improvisation. The mechanisms for wielding power are for the most part not established firmly, and there is considerable room for accident and for the arbitrary and unregulated application of power. Socially, psychologically, and physically, conditions still exist for the expression of some form of opposition. In short, there are many seams on the surface which can split apart before the entire power structure has managed to stabilize. Our system, on the other hand, has been developing in the Soviet Union for over 60 years and for approximately 30 years in Eastern Europe. Moreover, several of its long-established structural features are derived from Tsarist absolutism. In terms of the physical aspects of power, this has led to the creation of such intricate and well-developed mechanisms for the direct and indirect manipulation of the entire population that, as a physical power base, it represents something radically new. At the same time, let us not forget that the system is made significantly more effective by state ownership and central direction of all the means of production. This gives the power structure an unprecedented and uncontrollable capacity to invest in itself in the areas of the bureaucracy and the police, for example, and makes it easier for that structure, as the sole employer, to manipulate the day-to-day existence of all citizens. Finally, if an atmosphere of revolutionary excitement, heroism, dedication, and boisterous violence on all sides characterizes classical dictatorships, then the last traces of such an atmosphere have vanished from the Soviet bloc. For some time now, this bloc has ceased to be a kind of enclave, isolated from the rest of the developed world and immune to processes occurring in it. To the contrary, the Soviet bloc is an integral part of that larger world, and it shares and shapes the world's destiny. This means, in concrete terms, that the hierarchy of values existing in the developed countries of the West has, in essence, appeared in our society. The long period of coexistence with the West has only hastened this process. In other words, what we have here is simply another form of the consumer and industrial society with all its concomitant social, intellectual, and psychological consequences. It is impossible to understand the nature of power in our system properly without taking this into account. The profound difference between our system, in terms of the nature of power, and what we traditionally understand by dictatorship, a difference I hope is clear even from this quite superficial comparison, has caused me to search for some term appropriate for our system, purely for the purposes of this essay. If I refer to it henceforth as a post-totalitarian system, I am fully aware that this is perhaps not the most precise term. But I am unable to think of a better one. I do not wish to imply by the prefix post that the system is no longer totalitarian. On the contrary, I mean that it is totalitarian in a fundamentally different way from classical dictatorships, different from totalitarianism as we usually understand it. The circumstances I have mentioned, however, form only a circle of conditional factors and a kind of phenomenal framework. For the actual composition of power in the post-totalitarian system, several aspects of which I shall now attempt to identify. The manager of a fruit and vegetable shop places in his window, among the onions and carrots, the slogan, "Workers of the world, unite." Why does he do it? What is he trying to communicate to the world? Is he genuinely enthusiastic about the idea of unity among the workers of the world? Is his enthusiasm so great that he feels an irrepressible impulse to acquaint the public with his ideas? Has he really given more than a moment's thought to how such a unification might occur and what it would mean? I think it can safely be assumed that the overwhelming majority of shopkeepers never think about the slogans they put in their windows, nor do they use them to express their real opinions. That poster was delivered to our greengrocer from the enterprise headquarters, along with the onions and carrots. He put them all into the window simply because it has been done that way for years, because everyone does it, and because that is the way it has to be. If he were to refuse, there could be trouble. He could be reproached for not having the proper decoration in his window. Someone might even accuse him of disloyalty. He does it because these things must be done if one is to get along in life. It is one of the thousands of details that guarantee him a relatively tranquil life in harmony with society, as they say. Obviously, the greengrocer is indifferent to the semantic content of the slogan on exhibit. He does not put the slogan in his window from any personal desire to acquaint the public with the ideal it expresses. This, of course, does not mean that his action has no motive or significance at all, or that the slogan communicates nothing to anyone. The slogan is really a sign, and as such, it contains a subliminal but very definite message. Verbally, it might be expressed this way. I, the greengrocer XY, live here, and I know what I must do. I behave in the manner expected of me. I can be depended upon and am beyond reproach. I am obedient, and therefore I have the right to be left in peace. This message, of course, has an addressee. It is directed above, to the greengrocer's superior, and at the same time, it is a shield that protects the greengrocer from potential informers. The slogan's real meaning, therefore, is rooted firmly in the greengrocer's existence. It reflects his vital interests. But what are those vital interests? Let us take note. If the greengrocer had been instructed to display the slogan, "I'm afraid," and therefore unquestioningly obedient, he would not be nearly as indifferent to its semantics, even though the statement would reflect the truth. The greengrocer would be embarrassed and ashamed to put such an unequivocal statement of his own degradation in the shop window, and quite naturally so, for he is a human being, and thus has a sense of his own dignity. To overcome this complication, his expression of loyalty must take the form of a sign which, at least on its textual surface, indicates a level of disinterested conviction. It must allow the greengrocer to say, "What's wrong with the workers of the world uniting?" Thus the sign helps the greengrocer to conceal from himself the low foundations of his obedience, at the same time concealing the low foundations of power. It hides them behind the facade of something high, and that something is ideology. Ideology is a specious way of relating to the world, It offers human beings the illusion of an identity, of dignity, and of morality, while making it easier for them to part with them. As the repository of something suprapersonal and objective, it enables people to deceive their conscience and conceal their true position and their inglorious modus vivendi, both from the world and from themselves. It is a very pragmatic, but at the same time, an apparently dignified way of legitimizing what is above, below, and on either side. It is directed toward people and toward God. It is a veil behind which human beings can hide their own fallen existence, their trivialization, and their adaptation to the status quo. It is an excuse that everyone can use, from the greengrocer who conceals his fear of losing his job behind an alleged interest in the unification of the workers of the world, to the highest functionary whose interest in staying in power can be cloaked in phrases about service to the working class. The primary excusatory function of ideology, therefore, is to provide people, both as victims and pillars of the post-totalitarian system, with the illusion that the system is in harmony with the human order and the order of the universe. The smaller a dictatorship and the less stratified by modernization the society under it, the more directly the will of the dictator can be exercised. In other words, the dictator can employ more or less naked discipline, avoiding the complex processes of relating to the world and of self-justification which ideology involves. But the more complex the mechanisms of power become, the larger and more stratified the society they embrace, and the longer they have operated historically, the more individuals must be connected to them from outside, and the greater the importance attached to the ideological excuse. It acts as a kind of bridge between the regime and the people, across which the regime approaches the people and the people approach the regime. This explains why ideology plays such an important role in post-totalitarian systems. That complex machinery of units, hierarchies, transmission belts, and indirect instruments of manipulation which ensure, in countless ways, the integrity of the regime, leaving nothing to chance, would be quite simply unthinkable without ideology acting as its all-embracing excuse and as the excuse for each of its parts. Between the aims of the post-totalitarian system and the aims of life, there is a yawning abyss. While life, in its essence, moves towards plurality, diversity, independent self-constitution and self-organization, in short, towards the fulfillment of its own freedom, the post-totalitarian system demands conformity, uniformity, and discipline. While life ever strives to create new and improbable structures, the post-totalitarian system contrives to force life into its most probable states. The aims of the system reveal its most essential characteristic to be introversion, a movement toward being ever more completely and unreservedly itself, which means that the radius of its influence is continually widening as well. This system serves people only to the extent necessary to ensure that people will serve it. Anything beyond this, that is to say, anything which leads people to overstep their predetermined roles, is regarded by the system as an attack upon itself. And in this respect, it is correct. Every instance of such transgression is a genuine denial of the system. It can be said, therefore, that the inner aim of the post-totalitarian system is not merely preservation of power in the hands of a ruling clique, as appears to be the case at first sight. Rather, the social phenomenon of self-preservation is subordinated to something higher, to a kind of blind automatism which drives the system. No matter what positions individuals hold in the hierarchy of power, they are not considered by the system to be worth anything in themselves, but only as things intended to fuel and serve this automatism. For this reason, an individual's desire for power is admissible only insofar as its direction coincides with the direction of the automatism of the system. Ideology, in creating a bridge of excuses between the system and the individual, spans the abyss between the aims of the system and the aims of life. It pretends that the requirements of the system derive from the requirements of life. It is a world of appearances, trying to pass for reality. The post-totalitarian system touches people at every step, but it does so with its ideological gloves on. This is why life in the system is so thoroughly permeated with hypocrisy and lies. Government by bureaucracy is called popular government. The working class is enslaved in the name of the working class. the complete degradation of the individual is presented as his ultimate liberation. Depriving people of information is called making it available. The use of power to manipulate is called the public control of power, and the arbitrary use of power is called observing the legal code. The repression of culture is called its development. The expansion of imperial influence is presented as support for the oppressed. The lack of free expression becomes the highest form of freedom. Farcical elections become the highest form of democracy. Banning independent thought becomes the most scientific of worldviews. Military occupation becomes fraternal assistance. Because the regime is captive to its own lies, it must falsify everything. It falsifies the past. It falsifies the present. And it falsifies the future. It falsifies statistics. It pretends not to possess an omnipotent and unprincipled police apparatus. It pretends to respect human rights. It pretends to persecute no one. It pretends to fear nothing. It pretends to pretend nothing. Individuals need not believe all these mystifications, but they must behave as though they did, or they must at least tolerate them in silence, or get along well with those who work with them. For this reason, however, they must live within a lie. They need not accept the lie. It is enough for them to have accepted that their life with it and in it. For by this very fact, individuals confirm the system, fulfill the system, make the system, are the system. We have seen that the real meaning of the Green Grocer's slogan has nothing to do with what the text of the slogan actually says. Even so, this real meaning is quite clear and generally comprehensible because the code is so familiar. The Green Grocer declares his loyalty, and he can do no other if his declaration is to be accepted, in the only way the regime is capable of hearing, that is, by accepting the prescribed ritual, by accepting appearances as reality, by accepting the given rules of the game. In doing so, however, he has himself become a player in the game, thus making it possible for the game to go on, for it to exist in the first place. If ideology was originally a bridge between the system and the individual as an individual, then the moment he steps onto this bridge, it becomes at the same time a bridge between the system and the individual as a component of the system. That is, if ideology originally facilitated, by acting outwardly, the constitution of power by serving as a psychological excuse, then from the moment that excuse is accepted, it constitutes power inwardly, becoming an active component of that power. It begins to function as the principal instrument of ritual communication within the system of power. The whole power structure, and we have already discussed its physical articulation, could not exist at all if there were not a certain metaphysical order binding all its components together, interconnecting them, and subordinating them to a uniform method of accountability, supplying the combined operation of all these components with the rules of the game, that is, with certain regulations, limitations, and legalities. This metaphysical order is fundamental to and standard throughout the entire power structure. It integrates its communication system and makes possible the internal exchange and transfer of information and instructions. It is rather like a collection of traffic signals and directional signs, giving the process shape and structure. This metaphysical order guarantees the inner coherence of the totalitarian power structure. It is the glue holding it together, its binding principle, the instrument of its discipline. Without this glue, the structure as a totalitarian structure would vanish. It would disintegrate into individual atoms chaotically, colliding with one another in their unregulated particular interests and inclinations. The entire pyramid of totalitarian power, deprived of the element that binds it together, would collapse in upon itself, as it were, in a kind of material implosion. As the interpretation of reality by the power structure, ideology is always subordinated ultimately to the interests of the structure. Therefore, it has a natural tendency to disengage itself from reality, to create a world of appearances, to become ritual. In societies where there is a public competition for power, and therefore public control of that power, There also exists quite naturally public control of the way that power legitimizes itself ideologically. Consequently, in such conditions, there are always certain correctives that effectively prevent ideology from abandoning reality altogether. Under totalitarianism, however, these correctives disappear, and thus there is nothing to prevent ideology from becoming more and more removed from reality, gradually turning into what has already become in the post-totalitarian system, a world of appearances, a mere ritual, a formalized language deprived of semantic contact with reality, and transformed into a system of ritual signs that replace reality with pseudo-reality. Yet as we have seen, ideology becomes at the same time an increasingly important component of power, a pillar providing it with both excusatory legitimacy and an inner coherence. As this aspect grows in importance and as it gradually loses touch with reality, it acquires a peculiar but very real strength. It becomes reality itself, albeit a reality altogether self-contained, one that on certain levels, chiefly inside the power structure, may have even greater weight than reality as such. Increasingly, the virtuosity of the ritual becomes more important than the reality hidden behind it. The significance of phenomena no longer derives from the phenomena themselves, but from their locus as concepts in the ideological context. Reality does not shape theory, but rather the reverse. Thus, power gradually draws closer to ideology than it does to reality. It draws its strength from theory and becomes entirely dependent on it. This inevitably leads, of course, to a paradoxical result. Rather than theory, or rather ideology serving power, power begins to serve ideology. It is as though ideology had appropriated power from power, as though it had become dictator itself. It then appears that theory itself, ritual self, ideology itself, makes decisions that affect people and not the other way around. If ideology is the principal guarantee of the inner consistency of power, it becomes at the same time an increasingly important guarantee of its continuity. Whereas succession to power in classical dictatorship is always a rather complicated affair, the pretenders have nothing to give their claims reasonable legitimacy, thereby forcing them always to resort to confrontations of naked power. In the post-totalitarian system, power is passed on from person to person, from clique to clique, and from generation to generation in an essentially more regular fashion. In the selection of pretenders, a new kingmaker takes part. It is ritual legitimation, the ability to rely on ritual, to fulfill it and use it, to allow oneself, as it were, to be borne aloft by it. Naturally, power structures exist in the post-totalitarian system as well, and most of them are far more brutal than in an open society, for the struggle is not open, regulated by democratic rules and subject to public control, but hidden behind the scenes. It is difficult to recall a single instance in which the first secretary of a ruling communist party has been replaced without the various military and security forces being placed at least on alert. The struggle, however, can never, as it can in classical dictatorships, threaten the very essence of the system and its continuity. At most, it will shake up the power structure, which will recover quickly, precisely because the binding substance, ideology, remains undisturbed. No matter who is replaced by whom, succession is only possible against the backdrop and within the framework of a common ritual. It can never take place by denying that ritual. Because of this dictatorship of the ritual, however, power becomes clearly anonymous. Individuals are almost dissolved in the ritual. They allow themselves to be swept along by it, and frequently it seems as though ritual alone carries people from obscurity into the light of power. Is it not characteristic of the post-totalitarian system that on all levels of the power hierarchy, individuals are increasingly being pushed aside by faceless people, puppets, those uniformed flunkies of the rituals and routines of power? The automatic operation of a power structure thus dehumanized and made anonymous is a feature of the fundamental automatism of this system. It would seem that it is precisely the diktats of this automatism which select people lacking individual will for the power structure, that it is precisely the diktat of the empty phrase which summons to power people who use empty phrases as the best guarantee that the automatism of the post-totalitarian system will continue. Western Sovietologists often exaggerate the role of individuals in the post-totalitarian system and overlook the fact that the ruling figures, despite the immense power they possess through the centralized power structure, are often no more than blind executors of the system's own internal laws, laws of them, they themselves never can and never do reflect upon. In any case, experience has taught us again and again that this automatism is far more powerful than the will of any individual, and should someone possess a more independent will, he must conceal it behind a ritually anonymous mask, in order to have an opportunity to enter the power hierarchy at all. And when the individual finally gains a place there and tries to make his will felt within it, that automatism, with its enormous inertia, will triumph sooner or later. And either the individual will be ejected by the power structure like a foreign organism, or he will be compelled to resign his individuality gradually, once again blending with the automatism and becoming its servant, almost indistinguishable from those who preceded him and those who will follow. The necessity of continually hiding behind and relating to ritual means that even the more enlightened members of the power structure are often obsessed with ideology. They are never able to plunge straight to the bottom of naked reality, and they will always confuse it in the final analysis with ideological pseudo-reality. It can be said, therefore, that ideology, as that instrument of internal communication which assures the power structure of inner cohesion, is, in the post-totalitarian system, something that transcends the physical aspects of power, something that dominates it to a considerable degree, and therefore tends to assure its continuity as well. It is one of the pillars of the system's external stability. This pillar, however, is built on a very unstable foundation. It is built on lies. It works only as long as people are willing to live within the lie. Why, in fact, did our green grocer have to put his loyalty on display in the shop window? Had he not already displayed it sufficiently in various internal or semi-public ways? At trade union meetings, after all, he had always voted as he should. He had always taken part in the various competitions. He voted in elections like a good citizen. He'd even signed the anti-charter. Why, on top of all that, should he have to declare his loyalty publicly? After all, the people who walk past his window will certainly not stop to read that. In the greengrocer's opinion, the workers of the world ought to unite. The fact of the matter is, they don't read the slogan at all. And it can be fairly assumed they don't even see it. If you were to ask a woman who had stopped in front of a shop what she saw in the window, she would certainly tell whether or not they had tomatoes today. But it is highly unlikely that she noticed the slogan at all, let alone what it said. It seems senseless to require the green grocer to declare his loyalty publicly, but it makes sense nevertheless. People ignore his slogan, but they do so because such slogans are also found in other shop windows, on lampposts, bulletin boards, in apartment windows, and on buildings. They are everywhere, in fact. They form part of the panorama of everyday life. Of course, while they ignore the details, people are very aware of that panorama as a whole. And what else is the green grocer slogan but a small component in the huge backdrop to everyday life? The green grocer had to put the slogan in his window, therefore, not in the hope that someone might read it or be persuaded by it, but to contribute, along with thousands of other slogans, to the panorama that everyone is very much aware of. This panorama, of course, has a subliminal meaning as well. It reminds people where they are living and what is expected of them. It tells people what everyone else is doing, and it indicates to them what they must do as well if they don't want to be excluded, to fall into isolation, alienate themselves from society, break the rules of the game, and risk the loss of their peace and tranquility and security. The woman who ignored the greengrocer's slogan may well have hung a similar slogan just an hour before in the corridor of the office where she works. She did it more or less without thinking, just as our greengrocer did. And she could do so precisely because she was doing it against the backdrop of the general panorama and with some awareness of it, that is, against the background of the panorama of which the green grocer's shop window forms a part. When the green grocer visits her office, he will not notice her slogan either, just as she failed to notice his. Nevertheless, their slogans are mutually dependent. Both were displayed with some awareness of the general panorama, and we might say, under its diktat. Both, however, assist in the creation of that panorama, and therefore they assist in the creation of that diktat as well. The greengrocer and the office worker have both adapted to the conditions in which they live, but in doing so, they help to create those conditions. They do what is done, what is to be done, what must be done, but at the same time, by that very token, they confirm that it must be done in fact. They conform to a particular requirement, and in so doing, they themselves perpetuate that requirement. Metaphysically speaking, without the green grocer's slogan, the office worker's slogan could not exist, and vice versa. Each proposes to the other that something can be repeated, and each accepts the other's proposal. Their mutual indifference to each other's slogans is only an illusion. In reality, by exhibiting their slogans, each compels the other to accept the rules of the game and to confirm thereby the power that requires the slogans in the first place. Quite simply, each helps the other to be obedient. Both are objects in a system of control, but at the same time, they are its subjects as well. They are both victims of the system and its instruments. If an entire district town is plastered with slogans that no one reads, it is on the one hand a message from the district secretary to the regional secretary, but it is also something more, a small example of the principle of social auto-totality at work. Part of the essence of the post-totalitarian system is that it draws everyone into its sphere of power, not so they may realize themselves as human beings, but so they may surrender their human identity in favor of the identity of the system. That is, so they may become agents of the system's general automatism and servants of its self-determined goals. So they may participate in the common responsibility for it. So they may be pulled into and ensnared by it, like Faust, by Mephistopheles. More than this, so they may create, through their involvement, a general norm and thus bring pressure to bear on their fellow citizens. And further, so they may learn to be comfortable with their involvement, to identify with it, as though it were something natural and inevitable. And ultimately, so they may, with no external urging, come to treat any non-involvement as an abnormality, as arrogance, as an attack on themselves, as a form of dropping out of society. By pulling everyone into its power structure, the post-totalitarian system makes everyone an instrument of mutual totality, the auto-totality of society. Everyone, however, is in fact involved and enslaved, not only the green grocer, but also the prime ministers. Differing positions in the hierarchy merely establish differing degrees of involvement. The green grocer is involved only to a minor extent, but he also has very little power. The prime minister naturally has greater power, but in return, he is much more deeply involved. Both, however, are unfree, each merely in a somewhat different way. The real accomplice in this involvement, therefore, is not another person, but the system itself. Position in the power hierarchy determines the degree of responsibility and guilt, but it gives no one unlimited responsibility and guilt, nor does it completely absolve anyone. Thus, the conflict between the aims of life and the aims of the system is not a conflict between two socially defined and separate communities, and only a very generalized view, and even that only approximative, permits us to divide society into the rulers and the ruled. Here, by the way, is one of the most important differences between the post-totalitarian system and classical dictatorships, in which this line of conflict can still be drawn according to social class. In the post-totalitarian system, this line runs de facto through each person, for everyone in his own way is both a victim and a supporter of the system. What we understand by the system is not, therefore, a social order imposed by one group upon another, but rather something which permeates the entire society and is a factor in shaping it, something which may seem impossible to grasp or define, for it is in the nature of a mere principle, but which is expressed by the entire society as an important feature of its life. The fact that human beings have created and daily create the self-directed system through which they divest themselves of their innermost identity is not therefore the result of some incomprehensible misunderstanding of history, nor is it history somehow gone off the rails. Neither is it the product of some diabolical higher will which has decided, for reasons unknown, to torment a portion of humanity in this way. It can happen, and did happen, only because there is obviously in modern humanity a certain tendency towards the creation, or at least the toleration, of such a system. There is obviously something in human beings which responds to this system, something they reflect and accommodate, something within them which paralyzes every effort of their better selves to revolt. Human beings are compelled to live within a lie, but they can be compelled to do so only because they are in fact capable of living in this way. Therefore, not only does the system alienate humanity, but at the same time, alienated humanity supports the system as its own involuntary master plan, as a degenerate image of its own degeneration, as a record of people's own failure as individuals. The essential aims of life are present naturally in every person, in everyone. There is some longing for humanity's rightful dignity, for moral integrity, for free expression of being, and a sense of transcendence over the world of existence. Yet at the same time, each person is capable, to a greater or lesser degree, of coming to terms with living within the lie. Each person somehow succumbs to a profane trivialization of his inherent humanity and to utilitarianism. In everyone, there is some willingness to merge with the anonymous crowd and to flow comfortably along with it down the river of pseudo-life. This is much more than a simple conflict between two identities. It is something far worse. It is a challenge to the very notion of identity itself. In highly simplified terms, it could be said that the post-totalitarian system has been built on foundations laid by the historical encounter between dictatorship and the consumer society. Is it not true that the far-reaching adaptability to living a lie and the effortless spread of social auto-totality have some connection with the general unwillingness of consumption-oriented people to sacrifice some material certainties for the sake of their own spiritual and moral integrity? With their willingness to surrender higher values when faced with the trivializing temptations of modern civilization, with their vulnerability to the attractions of mass indifference. And in the end, is not the grayness and the emptiness of life in the post-totalitarian system only an inflated caricature of modern life in general? And do we not, in fact, stand, although in the external measures of civilization we are far behind, as a kind of warning to the West, revealing its own latent tendencies? Whew. All right, I'm going to stop there. I've been reading for 40 minutes or so. If you're still listening, you're awesome. this is from an essay called The Power of the Powerless, written in October 1978 by the Czech dramatist, political dissident, and later politician, Václav Havel. I will link in the show notes to the full text. I have read a fifth or a sixth of it, something like that. It goes on much, much longer. Maybe we'll come back to it someday. Yesterday, I read some Lech Walesa, and today, Viktor Havel. These individuals became, one started out, what was he, what was Walesa? An industrial worker, and Havel, apparently a dramatist. They became politicians, I suppose, just by encountering this communist system, this and totalitarian system. And it's a really interesting discussion for all of us, I think, what I read today. It's got me thinking about a lot of stuff, but the idea of a post-totalitarian system, still totalitarian, but somehow a next evolutionary step. And clearly, if you look out in the world today, there's not a lot of pure socialism, pure communism, or pure capitalism, for that matter. Something else is going on. Something else is definitely going on here, globally. We're dealing a lot right now inside our own borders within the U.S., coming to terms, this great reckoning on looking, this generation addressing again, for our moment in time, various kinds of inequities, and coming to terms with that, trying to understand them, trying to read them. I think it's really important, as we do, that everybody keeps talking, reading, studying, and because it's very tricky. Absolutely, we must battle these ideas, and battling ideas must remain okay. We don't want to entrap ourselves in a new totalizing system. It's a fascinating conundrum, a bit of a paradox that we encounter. And that's okay. Such is life. I really like, too, how when these almost accidental political leaders of huge impact in their countries, regions, in the world grapple with these ideas, they always get back to there's people. People want to do these things. They want to learn. They want to grow. They want to have skills. They want to go add value. Maybe they want to raise a family. They want freedom of thought, movement, action. And they were being impeded. And so they're inside a horrific, centralized, totalizing system. So it's interesting to read them, and this one, the part I just, concluded, still early in the essay, kind of introducing the idea that perhaps because they're living through this in their place and time, that they present a warning to the West. And here we are in the West too, I think appropriately looking inward and realizing what we take for granted. Clearly, I wouldn't want to trade places with somebody who's living in the Soviet bloc. I prefer to not live inside the Soviet bloc. That's an easy understatement. Meanwhile, here on this ground, the freedom and the stories of and the myths of and the songs of clearly have not always been all they've cracked up to be. Which brings us back to, from Wendell Berry to Julian Simon to Eleanor Ostrom, and even to Austin Kleon, frankly. It all converges. We all have a responsibility to ourselves and to each other to see things, to see things as they are, to look, and then to talk about it, to write about it, to really talk about it, to really write about it, and sort of, as it were, go about our business. But that is our business. What's beautiful about it, too, is each person that does that is a bulwark against these kinds of problems, these kinds of oppressions. That's Wendell Berry and Think Little, in essence. Looking forward to the next couple of days' readings. Be returning to American soil. It's an interesting couple of days. And I appreciate y'all for being along. We'll see where this goes next. Thanks.